The second case set for argument this morning is LJP Consulting versus Vervent. It's appeal number 30891. Sean Nichols is arguing on behalf of the defendant appellant, and Jacqueline Bowman will be arguing on behalf of the plaintiff appellee. Tim Shattuck is also at counsel table. So, Ms. Bowman, you may proceed with your argument this time. I'm sorry. I'm mixed around because you guys sat at different tables than what usually appellants over here. Mr. Nichols, you can proceed with argument.
Members of the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Jen, may it please the court. My name is Sean Nichols. I'm here on behalf of Vervent, Inc. This case involves nine one-page executed in 2012 between two entities, one of which is no longer in existence. And from that one-page contract, we now have a record before this court of 2,500 pages that includes almost close to 100 exhibits from a trial and resulting in a judgment that includes a permanent injunction for monetary relief, which is, according to this Supreme Court, viewed disfavorably and only in the most rare cases. So how do we get to that point? And that is what we're trying to sort out with multiple issues on appeal. I would say it would be impossible to go through 2,500 pages and give you any kind of argument with less than 2 hours. But the unifying thing that I think really tells the story here is that one-page contract requires, it's a service contract. So LJP refers business to Total Card, and for referring that business gets a percentage of the fee as long as there is a contract with a client. And that's what the contract requires. So you hold that 2012 contract up and compare it to a judgment, and the judgment says that now Vervent, who is not a party to the contract, has to continue paying a referral fee essentially forever so long as it's servicing the First Equity account, okay? So comparing the judgment to the contract, you can already see over 12 years they are fundamentally misaligned.
Well, we interpret contracts all the time. So what is it about this one, which everyone seems to agree is binding, whether it's one page or 100? What's the term? What do we need to interpret in this one?
Yeah, and I was just going to say, this court for decades. You interpret a contract according to its plain and ordinary meaning. You don't give it a strained interpretation. And that's unfortunately exactly what is going on here with the judgment, because the underlying contract requires there to be, okay, I refer business to you. I will pay you 3%. And it doesn't say so long as I have this business line. It says so long as I have a contract with a client, and it refers to client, or a renewal. And so what we have here is there needs to be an underlying contract in order for there to be an obligation for Vervent, who purchased TCI and now stands in their shoes, to pay. And in this case, there plainly isn't. Contracts are interpreted as a matter of law, the scope and existence, as this court has found. And we made that argument to the trial court that, either through directed verdict or for motion for judgment as a matter of law, that there is no underlying contract here and there. Should therefore be no obligation.
Can I ask you just a quick procedural question?
Thank you.
Yes. On appeal, because I want to make sure I didn't miss it, but it appears you were challenging the circuit court's denial of your judgment for motion as a matter of law after LJP submitted its case in chief. And then you're also appealing the court's denial of your Rule 50B motion after the jury's verdict. I didn't see, it's like you renewed the 50A motion at the end of all of the evidence. I didn't see that you were appealing that, but I just want to make sure
In our principal brief, you can see that I think it's on page 14 that we argued that particular point. But yes, I mean,
at the close of all the evidence, you think that
we renewed at the close of before our. Right after the jury returned their verdict? Is that what you're asking?
No, I know that one's clearly one of your issues, but I didn't see that you referred to the
I mean, the motion for judgment as a matter of law, 50A, they kind of blend into each other because they're ultimately a question of law that we are submitting to the court. But yes, and so going back to that issue and speaking specifically to the court's denial of our motion for judgment as a matter of law, it ties together with the issue that we've raised with respect to the motion in limine that was granted that prevented us from even explaining to the jury from the get-go that there had been this exhaustion of the underlying contract. There was no contract with a client, and so there, as such, there should be no continuing obligation. And so there was a motion in limine that was granted that prevented us from even explaining that to the jury. And then mid-trial, we moved for a directed verdict and then also asked the court to revisit that particular issue. And the court changed his mind and decided that that motion in limine that had been granted that prohibited us from discussing, you know, the exhaustion of the contract, we could now get that into evidence. And so one of the issues we've raised is that the timing of that initial granting of motion in limine and then reversal was prejudicial to us and is error as a matter of law. And the argument on the other side is that, well, you were prepared for trial, you were ready to make an offer of proof on this subject, and even though it was denied in our case in chief and in voir dire and opening statements, you're not prejudiced. And so while that is an abuse of discretion standard for this court, the trial court had already, by reversing himself on that issue, admitted an error of law. And so the only issue left to decide then is whether the timing of reversal is prejudicial to us. And I would submit, and although the trial court found against us, I, 23 years ago, was standing in this courtroom taking trial techniques class for the law students that are here. And in that class, we spent half of a semester talking about how you voir dire a jury, you pick a jury, how you build themes in your opening statement, how you expand on those themes in your cross-examination, all of which was denied to us in this trial. And I would submit the very fact that half of a semester of where I learned how to do these things was denied me in this case, it has to be prejudicial. I would also note, in terms of how we picked the jury, as an officer of the court, I will tell you that there were two jurors that I had to decide whether to choose for my panel based on the case that I suspect I would have to try versus the one that I thought I should be able to try. And so, I mean, decisions had to be made in voir dire that fundamentally were different than the case that ended up being tried. Also, I think on our motion for judgment of a matter of law, it is interesting because, you know, we obviously argued that the motion in limine to preclude evidence that Vervent had acquired First Equity, you know, was wrong. But in denying our motion for the matter, judgment as a matter of law, and this is on page 1899 of the record, the trial court ruled that, well, the jury has already spoken on that issue. And so you have kind of this interesting conundrum where the jury verdict is used to uphold the rationale for, you know, denying our motion for judgment as a matter of law, even though the jury was prevented during the plaintiff's case in chief, opening statement, and on voir dire, and even learning of, you know, a very complicated subject that, as I noted, has filled up 2,500 pages of the record. And so,
did the trial court allow the jury to interpret the contract?
And that is a very good question, Justice Salter. And we had argued in our motion in limine that this really is a question of law. It's not an ambiguous term in the contract. There needs to be an underlying client.
But even if it was ambiguous, we have rules of construction that allow courts to divine intent. I mean, even then, should that be submitted to a fact finder?
Absolutely not. And that's why I think our motion for directed verdict was on point. And the interesting thing, too, about that is the plaintiff's case in chief, they did not put in an underlying contract as part of their evidence to even establish a right to recover under the referral agreement.
That would be the renewal contract, the DCI client renewal contract, and that's the provision that really is at the center of this case.
That's exactly right. And just shifting the Tennessee Supreme Court, and we had cited in our reply brief the Check Velocity case, specifically looked at the question of the term renewal, and is that a question of law or is that an ambiguous term in a contract that goes to the jury, and the Tennessee Supreme Court helpfully decided that is a question of law, that a renewal is, and they cite Black's Law Dictionary and explain what a renewal is. It's just an extension of an existing contract. And so you have in the record the contracts that we put in, which are exhibits M and N from trial, showing that there was no renewal of the underlying contract. We have a very fundamentally different contract, TCI.
That case, I think, acknowledged that their renewals have been defined in different ways, but it also came to that conclusion, but it is often referred to synonymously with an extension. But then it looked at the overall totality of the contract that had the initial term and the renewal term and determined this one definitely was referring to an extension. And it does appear that the contract at issue here is very similar to the one that was in that case.
I think you're exactly right. It says TCI client and renewal all within the same couple of phrases. And so it's very clear that the contract here has that same language that the Tennessee Supreme Court found as positive in the check velocity case. And so, you know, we think judgment as a matter of law is infinitely appropriate based on the fact that there was no renewal here. And that's obvious. And that is clearly a question of law that isn't even something that a jury should be allowed to deny a motion for judgment as a matter of law based on what the jury found.
And it appeared, and I know I suspect, you know, opposing counsel made some arguments in the appellate brief that, well, maybe this language is ambiguous and that it was just left to the jury. The jury was not instructed. I didn't see anywhere where anyone or that either counsel asked the jury to be instructed that that term, the key term that we're addressing here, was ambiguous. The only ambiguity direction they had related to what is call center services, which is an issue not an issue in appeal. So they were really given no, even if that were the case, there was no guidance given to the jury as to what does a renewal mean or a client mean, and I assume that plays into your argument that this was really a matter of law for the
That's
court.
Right. And even when the motion in limine was heard in July of 2024, I told Judge the trial court that this was really a question of law. And unfortunately, we have two judges that presided over this case. And when Judge Song issued his summary judgment decision on page 5, he had referred to the fact that Mervyn continues to service the First Equity account. Even though that was, when he issued his decision in 23, that was no longer true, because when the plaintiffs moved for summary judgment, after they moved for summary judgment, that's when Vervent acquired the First Equity organization, and essentially the existence of, a servicer on one hand and a client on another hand collapsed. And at that point in time, it became one and the same. It's just, at this right now, it's money coming out of a left pocket into the right pocket. The client and the servicer are one and the same, and unfortunately still have this permanent injunction that requires us to pay 3% of revenue to LJP on money that we're generating for ourselves.
So it appeared to me that LJP was relying almost exclusively on these existing invoices that kept getting generated even after the acquisition of First Equity. Can you explain to me why, first, I also want to make sure, because it's a long record. I didn't see anywhere in the record where there was any evidence submitted by either party that there was actually any payments going from the Phoenix Card, who now held those asset receivables, to the intra-company servicer, Vervent, in that it was a different type of arrangement. Can you explain that?
Yeah, and that's exactly right. You're right on point. So invoices in and of themselves, as we cited in our brief, do not constitute any kind of evidence of contract. There would then need to be evidence of payment to make that extension that the invoices actually mean anything beyond just intercompany tracking. And that would have been the plaintiff's burden to show there had been payment actually exchanged between two related companies, and they didn't do that. And so, in my view, in looking at the record, there's no basis where they could have been awarded anything as a matter of law, because the burden was just not met as to either a contract or payments, let alone, we have the issue that the client has now become merged into Vervent. And of course, this leads to the very last issue that we've raised, which is the idea that a permanent injunction then is now the basis for an obligation going forward. We had cited the Brinkman versus Williams case. Paragraph 19 of that case makes very clear that permanent injunctions are only to be awarded in very unique cases. That was the only case that I was able to find in South Dakota that discussed permanent injunction in the context of money damages, in which this court had reversed. It's interesting how much the court had turned over just in 8 years, because I think, Justice Kern, you were the only one on that particular case from 2016. But in any event, I mean, the ruling in that case and the holding, I think, is dispositive here. This is not an unusual case at all. It's just a commercial case involving damages, and then to be saddled to a permanent injunction just seems at odds fundamentally with South Dakota law. And I would note, too, as part of the arguments on the permanent injunction, the language that the LJP had proposed to the court, two things. First, the trial court found that the permanent injunction was not authorized under the subpart 2, money damages being difficult, but rather under subpart 3 to prevent multiplicity of legal proceedings, and went on then to say that the language proposed by LJP was too broad in terms of the permanent injunction, and directed the parties then to submit more tailored language for the injunction, which I did, and LJP did not, and the trial court rejected the language that I proposed, which was straight out of the contract, and then went ahead and accepted and signed the judgment as originally proposed by LJP, even after, on the record, noting that the language was too broad, and that's on page 1900 of the record.
She got a red light if you want to wrap up.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bauman, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jacqueline Bowman, and along with my co-counsel, Tim Shattuck, we represent the appellee LJP Consulting LLC. This appeal really comes down to Vervent refusing to accept the consequences of its breach of the referral agreement while simultaneously accepting over $36 million in fees from LJP's referral of the first equity accounts. Vervent first argues that Judge Song got it wrong before trial in denying its motion to dismiss. Vervent then alleges that the jury got it wrong at trial by awarding continuing damages to LJP. Finally, Vervent alleges that Judge Barnett got it wrong after trial by awarding the permanent injunction. I'm going to look at each of these issues one by one. As to the first issue, Vervent's motion to dismiss was properly denied. Vervent repeatedly relies on the general rule that a contract without an end duration can be terminated at will. And that's certainly true. We don't dispute that the referral agreement itself, as it pertains to prospective referrals that we had not yet brought, could be terminated. However, there's a critical distinction that Vervent overlooks, and that's with respect to completed referrals, such as the first equity accounts. In that situation, where a party owes an obligation for a completed referral under a contract without an end duration, those obligations cannot be terminated unilaterally at will. That's an issue of first impression for this court, but it has been consistently upheld by courts across the country for over 100 years. One of the principal cases to look at this issue is the Warner-Lambert case, and that involved a royalty fee for the sale of Listerine. And like Vervent, the party in that case tried to argue that the agreement was a contract in perpetuity and could be terminated at will. The Warner court held that the mere fact that a contract continues for a very long time is no reason to do violence to the expressed intention of the parties. The Warner court ultimately held that that contract was not an impermissible contract in perpetuity because it was conditioned upon the continued manufacture and sale of Listerine. The same is true here. The referral agreement is not a contract in perpetuity. Rather, it continues so long as the referral fees continue, so long as Vervent is servicing the underlying first equity accounts.
I'm going to stop you.
Go ahead.
So that's a phrase, that you had proposed, and that's the one that ended up in the judgment. So long as Vervent continues servicing the first equity accounts. Where is that in the contract?
Thank you, Justice. I think that's an important question. And in looking at the referral agreement, there's a paragraph called a qualified referral. And it states that if the TCI client contractual relationship is renewed, an ongoing referral fee of 3% will continue to be paid to LJP Consulting LLC.
Okay, that's so that seems much more precise than what you are suggesting here, that it continues so long as there is servicing a Vervent of these accounts. So it does seem to ignore the specific terms relating to a client relationship and a renewal. So what is your position?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with that. I would state that that language does contemplate an ongoing client contractual relationship. It's one and the same with them continuing to service the accounts in sort of this servicer and client relationship. I wanted to, I think that ties into the case law that you had briefly mentioned when Mr. Nichols was presenting his argument. And I think the case law, as it pertains to that agreement where they were discussing a renewal and even how the term renewal is ambiguous, that's a distinction because they looked at the specific language of that contract, which clearly contemplated that the original contract would be renewed. And even in that case, the court said, renewal is an ambiguous term. But here we've got different.
Why don't we have that here? It seemed to be almost the exact same terms.
I respectfully, Your Honor, I think it's different because it doesn't contemplate the original contract being renewed or extended. It just says if any client contractual relationship is renewed, it could be the original formal contract.
It specifically refers to the TCI client contractual relationship.
Correct, Your Honor. And that just is referring to the relationship between the parties if they're continuing to service. It doesn't say it needs to be under the original servicing agreement. That could be effectuated by a number of means. It could be, the original formal contract from back in 2014. It could be a new contract that they enter. It could even be an informal implied in contract just based on servicing and the revenue paid for servicing.
But there would need to be a contract with a client. We have to give some significance to that term since it's there, don't we?
Yes, but I don't think it needs to be a formal contract or even the original contract, just so long as there's any contractual servicing relationship, which is what we proved at trial.
It's not the contract, it's the status. There's a status question. We know who TCI is. Well, TCI is Vervent, but this status question, who are the parties? I mean, the contract, its term, whether it's indefinite. I mean, to me, those are downstream. Is this a TCI client relationship? And so the status is client. Who's the client? And once they buy the client, does the client cease to exist?
Well, they haven't actually purchased the client. So really what you look at is the underlying credit cards. That's what LJP referred as the first equity credit card accounts. Those credit card accounts are still in existence, just as the same as they've always
been.
They
might think of that, but we're working with this contract, and so we have to have a client.
Understood, Your Honor. And I do believe that is still within the language of this contract, because the client contract relationship we now know is between Vervent and Phoenix Card Group as the successor to the first equity accounts. The Warner Court actually considered a somewhat similar issue because in that case, both parties were successors in interest to the original agreement. The law doesn't permit a party to reap the benefits of a referral and then to unilaterally discontinue its obligations.
So how would you define TCI, the text, TCI client contractual relationship? How would you define that text?
I would define that as any sort of ongoing client relationship to service the accounts, whether it's a formal contract, whether it's an informal arrangement to service these accounts. The language in the referral agreement is broad enough to incorporate any of those.
How would you define a client?
A client would be the individual or the business that owns the underlying receivables for the credit card accounts that were referred by LJP.
And is it the same client that's implied in the preceding text?
Yes, and along with any successors that hold those underlying receivables.
Speaking of successors, so the intercompany servicing agreement, the 2020 agreement, that under which those accounts, which are no longer owned by First Equity, are being serviced, was in existence prior to the acquisition of First Equity. It's a very different type of contract. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that it's a different contract, but at its core, it's still a servicing agreement. I don't think Vervent can skirt around its obligations under the referral agreement by, you know, servicing them under a different contract.
Well, that particular contract, there's language in that contract that specifically says when Phoenix Card acquired those first equity receivables, that it was not assuming any of the obligations of first equity.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
There's language in that servicing contract in which it states that Phoenix Card was assuming all of the rights but expressly excluded any obligations that had been owed by First Equity.
Well, Phoenix Card Group doesn't have any of the obligations.
Well, and when I say First Equity, I realize there are other subsidiaries that are the ones that that contract actually relate to, but
right. So it still would be Vervent that has it's. They're still receiving the revenue. They're still servicing the same accounts that LJP referred. So they, regardless of what servicing agreement they're servicing it under, they still owe LJP the corresponding referral fee.
So all of this that we're discussing here, do you disagree that this really should have been a matter of law for the court to determine whether or not the terms of the referral contract still existed, given the nature of the existing servicing contract? I mean, how on earth would a jury make these determinations as we're having these discussions here? And they were never instructed that this was a disputed issue, how this contract was interpreted.
So I do think you could look at the contract and say that it is ambiguous as to what constitutes an ongoing client contractual relationship. And Vervent repeatedly argued before the trial court that this should be a question of fact for the jury to decide. So I do think they've waived that argument.
Well, actually, I don't think that's accurate. They first asked the court to determine this as a matter of law for all the reasons that they're arguing here. And then as I read it, then they made an alternative argument that said, and in the event the court doesn't find that, then at a minimum, the jury should get to decide whether or not this is still occurring, whether or not this is still a renewed client contractual relationship. But I didn't see anywhere where anyone argued to the court that this is ambiguous language here that we need to submit to a jury with some instruction and guidance as to how they figure out what this means.
Instructed generally on ambiguity, and I think the verdict form was structured in a way that they were asked to itemize fees each month. So if they found after March 2022 that first equity acquisition cut off damages, then they could have certainly entered zeros for each month after that on the verdict.
But the only ambiguity they were told existed was what do call center services mean, and that was a different issue that is not on appeal here.
Right, because certainly the central issue at trial was how call center services are calculated for purposes of damages. But to the extent that this court finds it was an issue of law, I think Judge Barnett's initial reasoning in the motion in limine is instructive, because the fact that Vervent and Phoenix are two separate legal entities and there was clearly evidence of ongoing servicing, I think as a matter of law, that establishes that point in LJP's favor, that there was an ongoing client contractual relationship pursuant to the terms of the referral agreement. I think also it's worth pointing out that the referral agreement sort of is, you know, the classic law school hypothetical on a unilateral contract. If A says to B, I'll give you $100 to climb the flagpole, once B's halfway up the flagpole, that offer can't be revoked. Well, here LJP climbed the flagpole, they retrieved the flag, and they brought it back in the form of the first equity referral. It would be against, you know, all these cases that have upheld that referral fee continues so long as the business relationship continues, which brings me to the second issue that we've already been addressing, but that's pertaining to both the motion in limine ruling and the evidence that supported the jury's verdict. And as it pertains to the motion in limine regarding the first equity acquisition, there really was no prejudice here because it was reversed prior to Vervent's case in chief. They were able to introduce all of the evidence they wanted on the first equity acquisition. And I know they mentioned that they didn't get to cross-examine LJP's witnesses on the acquisition, but we only called two witnesses, Alonzo Primus from LJP and Paul Simon. Neither of those witnesses had any foundation pertaining to the first equity acquisition, and certainly a fervent thought there was something they should be cross-examined. They could have recalled them in their own case in chief. Alonzo Primus was LJP's principal. He was available at counsel table the entire duration of trial. And Paul Simon is actually an employee of Vervent, so certainly within their purview to recall as a witness. I think it really boils down to not only has Vervent failed to show prejudice with the motion in limine ruling, but they've also failed to show that that ruling in all probability affected the jury's verdict, which is the standard that this court needs to consider. And I think that ties into the second issue, which we've addressed a little bit, which is that the evidence did support the jury's ultimate verdict on continuing damages.
You think that First Equity is still Vervent's client?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Well, through their successor, the First Equity accounts as being held by Phoenix Card Group is the client now.
They own that?
They do not own it. No, I would dispute that, Your Honor. Vervent Inc. and Phoenix Card Group are two separate legal entities. If you look at Exhibit DD that was introduced at trial, they are cousin entities under a, you know, a parent company. If you go down a few levels, they're separate legal entities. And in fact, they're structured that way intentionally. Vervent Card's president testified that Vervent doesn't want the risk associated with the underlying receivables. It would be unjust to allow them to take advantage of the doctrine of corporate separateness and then also, you know, at the same time say, well, we own these accounts, so we no longer have to pay the fee on it.
But that gets back to Justice Devaney's earlier question about, you know, is First Equity a client after the acquisition? In this situation, isn't that determination a matter of law, not for the jury to, you know, regardless of how they're set up, structured, and then you've got these invoices and they're stamped, you know, a client or serve, whatever it is. And so I know those were a big part of your case, but all of that's really just a question of law. Is it still on under the contract? Is First Equity still a client? Would you disagree with that?
I mean, you could look at it that way, I guess, to the extent there's an ambiguity as to what it means to have an ongoing client contractual relationship, then that's properly considered for the jury as to a question of fact as to, you know, maybe what that term means. But certainly contract interpretation, as Your Honor noted, is a question of law.
The other thing I want to ask you about before your time gets away on the injunctive issue,
yes.
The injunction issue. This is a collection suit. Plain and simple, that's what it is. You owe us money, we're going to collect the money. I don't know if I've ever seen an injunctive relief entered in a collection lawsuit before. So you won, assuming that's upheld. You win. Are the future amounts that may or may not be owed, are those even ripe in terms of the court granting injunctive relief?
They are right because Vervent has already indicated that they're not willing to pay those future referral fees. So to that extent, it would be an anticipatory.
Well, they argued that at trial, but then they lost.
Correct. But even after the jury verdict, they still were disputing whether they need to pay those future fees. And I, when you look at, you know, and I see I'm out of time, if I could just briefly address that. Thank you, Your Honor. When you look at, you know, here, the injunction is necessary, and it is sort of one of those unique situations. Unlike the Magner case that Vervent cites, we didn't ask for a lump sum future payment. I mean, that would just be impossible to calculate. We don't know when, you know, or how much each of these referral fees will be owed each month. And I think you mentioned this is sort of a unique circumstance. I just want to leave the court with the quote from the Nielsen case, which states that specific performance is, you know, the vehicle we use by the permanent injunction. That specific performance does more perfect and complete justice. So that is an upheld occasion to use it, and that's certainly the case here, because under the injunction, we're not asking Vervent to pay any more or less than it's owed under the referral agreement just to honor those future referral fees. I would ask this court respectfully to affirm in all respects. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Nichols, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a couple follow-ups to some of the questions that this panel had asked. Justice Salter, well, I'll start with you, Justice Jensen. You had asked the question related to the permanent injunction. I find it interesting that the justification for the permanent injunction was to prevent multiplicity of action. And here my client is stuck with a judgment that they have no idea how to comply with or how to get out of it, which goes back to the issue from the very beginning. Like, we have a contract that just continues in perpetuity, contrary to South Dakota law. And I think that permanent injunction just bookends that problem. Justice Salter, you had asked about some of the questions related to, is there a client? And respectfully, I would submit, when this contract was signed, it was between TCI and LJP. LJP referred a company called First Equity Card Corporation. Exhibits N and M, which are the underlying contracts of the client, are with related entities, but not the entity that was referred. So they were using the corporate separateness, the First Equity organization, in which LJP reaped the benefit of that 3%. So if they're saying now on the back end that we don't get to claim that this is an organizational structure, an intercompany agreement, then we should have never paid them in the first place, because it was intercompany agreements that established this relationship and servicing the credit cards from the get-go. And I would respectfully submit for those students taking corporation law here and learning how to structure corporations and why an organization might have multiple companies in it for different reasons, like that, again, just seems so immaterial based on if this is the outcome that we're going to face. Going back to your questions, Justice Devaney, regarding the language in the contract, and you obviously have read the Check Velocity case, which I appreciate, but to me, that just tells the story here. This is a question of law, whether there was a renewal, whether there was a client. There clearly is not. At the end, what we're facing here, and again, in 5 minutes, it's hard to spit out everything that is important in this case, but we have a contract that just, it runs in perpetuity, even though South Dakota law disfavors contracts that run forever. This is all sandwiched in the middle of a motion in limine, where if this is a question of fact, which I don't think it is, I think it's a question of law, but if it is a question of fact, to say that a dispositive issue that the jury should have been instructed on, if it is a question of fact, which the jury's verdict was used to deny our motion for judgment as a matter of law, if that's not prejudicial to be ordered not to refer to this important critical fact during voir dire, opening statement and cross-examination, I mean, if that is not prejudicial, I don't know what is. I've been practicing for 23 years. I've tried 30 cases. And again, as an officer of the court, I can't tell you how difficult this was to try this case with the sand moving under your feet. And I would tell all the young lawyers in this courtroom, I mean, you can expect that. The trials are dynamic. The sand always shifts under your feet, but this is beyond the pale. And so I would submit again, although the Supreme Court has not talked about the timing in which a motion in limine is granted or reversed, having a critical issue being denied discussion during half of a trial, I would say is per se prejudice. And then lastly, as to the judgment as a matter of law, again, clearly I had explained in the motions hearing prior to the trial that, you know, the existence of a client really is a question of law and there isn't a client. LJP in their motion for summary judgment even agreed to restrict their partial summary judgment to the time of the acquisition, understanding that this is kind of an important development, that there no longer is a client, that Vervent has acquired the whole organization and there isn't that separateness necessary or needed in order to continue paying the 3%. And so there's multiple grounds for reversal in this case. I think they're plain. I would ask the court to remand this case, most importantly on the question of whether this contract could be terminated freely from the get-go, but alternatively, the motion for judgment as a matter of law should have been granted, and the permanent injunction, again, is an error, and at a minimum, the granting of the motion in limine, restricting testimony on the critical issue, is per se prejudice in my view, and should be reversed for those reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning.